The Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.
Hi, and welcome to the Business, Property and Wealth Creation Podcast. My name's Dan Latto, and with me today, I've got an interview with a lady called Linda Wright. Welcome, Linda. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and thank you for calling me a lady.
I'm sure, like me, you've been called lots of things. Let's face it, in this business, it just goes with territory, doesn't it? So Linda runs a company called Planet Right, and needless to say, Linda, you help people get planning permission, either before they've purchased a property or when they've actually purchased it, or for an advisory point of view, talking about moving a commercial property into residential, which is pretty big right now. So there's loads of different things I want to talk about, but I'm going to start with the big one for me right now is commercial to residential. So just talk to me about why this is so big right now, because there's been some changes in the government or an extension, hasn't there, on the rights. For, just talk to me a little bit about what those rights are for me.
Right. How long have you got? Are we going to be here till the weekend? It's a big, sexy planning issue. Everybody is looking at the office to residential conversion. Now the reason that it's a bit more interesting, shall we say, at the moment, is because just last month on the 6th of April, so this is, you know, hot off the press, complete update.
Yeah.
The central government made the office to residential permitted development rights. And I say it like that because I'm almost saying it with inverted commas around
yes.
it. And I'll say why in a minute. They made the permitted development rights to change B1A offices, and that's important as well. It's not all offices. It's general offices. So it's not financial and professional services. It's not the smaller offices. It tends to be more general offices. They made that right permanent, which means it's on the same sort of footing now as a full planning application, because once you get the prior approval of the council, and it's a weird sort of hybrid application, once you get that prior approval, you have that lasts then for 3 years. Now, previously, there was a long stop date, and we've now gone past that. It was the 30th of May this
yep.
year, just Sunday, Monday or Sunday.
Yep.
That's the reason that this is the big sexy issue now, is because it is no longer a temporary interim right. It's actually been made permanent. It's part of the legislation. You have rights similar to a full planning application in that the permission lasts for 3 years once you've got it.
Yep.
Now, there are lots of other permitted development rights, as they're called, and they're badged as permitted development rights. They're not really. It's not a true permitted development. Permitted development rights there are certain permitted development rights where you don't need to submit any application at all. But with this one, you do have to submit a planning application, and it's called a prior approval or prior notification application. And the council will look at it, and even though it's badged a permitted development, they can still refuse it. And that's very important, because a lot of people still don't realise. They come to me and say, oh, well, they've refused it. They can't do that. Well, yeah, they can.
Yeah.
Councils can still refuse these. If they don't comply with the criteria, they can still be refused. So that's a big thing that you need to know.
Okay, so it's almost like there's permitted development, but within the permitted development, there's a set of rules that everybody has to abide by. And as long as you abide by those rules, then yes, it's more than likely going to get approved. But if you step out of those rules, it's like anything really, then it's not going to get approved, right?
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of twists and turns and complicated little bits with this. Basically, if we look at there are lots of other prior approval applications. Basically, if we look at the office to residential permitted development rights,
yeah.
and now be made permanent, you can't do this on a listed building,
yeah.
and certainly not on a scheduled ancient monument. And you can't do it if it's in certain safety hazard or military explosives area,
yeah.
which you would expect, really.
Yeah.
But the council can only look at this on, and this is the real reason why there are benefits and opportunities here. The council can only determine these prior approval or prior notification applications on, now, it used to be three issues, it's now four because it's changed on the 6th of April.
Yeah.
So they can only look at it on the transport and highways impact of the development, that's number one. Number two is if it's on contaminated land.
Yeah.
Number three is a flood risk issue. And number four now, which has been added, is a noise assessment.
Okay.
So for any application that you submit, you have to submit information that proves to the council that your application, your proposal, is going to be acceptable in all of these four areas.
Yep.
Now, the noise assessment is if the future residents of the offices, once they're changed to flats, if the future residents are going to be affected by external noise, i.e. noise from outside,
yep,
impacting on the people who are going to be living there.
Okay.
So that's a big one now. That's a big change. But part of the advantages of this are you can still do this in a conservation area. And a lot of people, again, don't realise that. They see listed building, can't do it in a listed building. But they don't realise, because there's very little change usually to these proposals, very little change to the outside of the building, they can still be done in conservation areas. And in fact, I've done one fairly recently in a conservation area. The reason that everybody gets excited about these, and probably the main reason, is that especially in the 33 London boroughs, where there is the London plan and very specific sizes,
yep,
for flats, with these applications, the council cannot get involved in the size of units. So a lot of, now I'm not advocating, you know, people living in cupboards. That's not what I'm about. But certainly unit sizes, the flat sizes, can be smaller than the London plan insists on.
So that's really interesting because, let's face it, we've got a problem with housing in this country and it's, yeah, you know, we're not building enough. Net migration is up. People are coming into the country more than people are leaving. Birth rates are up and all that sort of thing. So people need somewhere to live. And yet they're not building on green land effectively, not to the certain amounts that we need. And in London, I mean, I read a report in London's got another like 4 million people coming in the next 10 years. Well, where are they going to live? I mean, it's just ridiculous. So they've got no choice than to provide the shoeboxes effectively with a bed and a kitchen in, you know, next to each other. Because where else are they going to put these people?
I don't want to get into the arguments about, you know, room sizes and standards and you know, slum dwellings and all, yeah, of this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we're getting dangerously close to a Brexit argument there, and I don't think
that route. Just quickly on the Brexit, I really couldn't care one way or the other. It's nothing to do with me. I mean, I live in Spain, as you know, and it will affect me in some way. But you know what? My take on this for the last 17 years of being involved in property is I don't care what anybody does, what the government does. You can tax us to the hilt. That's already happening. It won't affect what I do. And that's me being independent and away from all this stuff. Because what happens is you get drilled down into this Brexit argument and you end up having arguments on Facebook, you know, yeah, politics and religion always ends in an argument. But it makes no difference. Your own financial situation is more important than anything else. And that's what people should be focusing on, not putting a tick in a box. I've got a tick, you've got a tick. The most brainiest man in England, he's got a tick. And the stupidest, most thickest person in England, they've got a tick as well, right? So how does that work? So my point on Brexit, or even, you know, if you think that changing your life once every 4 years with a changing government is going to change your life, and I think you're crazy. It's got nothing to do with me. It's just, you let other people get on with having that argument. I'll get on with making money. Thanks very much.
Right. Thank you. Are you getting down off your soapbox?
You know me, Linda.
That was brilliant. I enjoyed that. Right, I'm making no further comments about Brexit.
Good stuff.
Okay, so that's the big thing. This is a very, very important issue. for people who will be looking to invest or to develop or to, they're already developers in the London boroughs.
Yeah.
The London plan is very specific and very restrictive in there. And to a certain extent, Manchester, who are going to get their own mayor and devolved powers, until they have their own particular document, and it's not out yet, they are adopting the sizes in the London plan as well.
Got it.
So from that point of view, it will be important in Greater Manchester as yeah. well. So that's the main point and the reason. And the other point, it's a knock-on effect. Most of these buildings that are converted from office to residential have no car parking provision. Most of them have no outdoor amenity space. And that in and of itself can sometimes cause traffic problems. And, you know, if people have no amenity space, where do they go? They have to go to use parks and leisure services yeah. and all that kind of thing. So, so from that point of view, that's the reason that everybody who's jumped on this, they think they can make money and they can sort of circumvent the general planning policies of each local council.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is it's a slightly simpler application process. Not much, but ever so slightly. The other big thing is that councils cannot hang on to these applications. In the past, a lot of councils have hung on to applications for flatted developments, you know, large sort of 150 to 100 flats or over. They've hung on to these and they've dragged them out for months and years and they've had Section 106 agreements and all of this kind of stuff. Councils cannot do that now. These applications, these prior approval, prior notification applications, have to be dealt with by the council within 56 days.
Yeah.
Now, I know that's 8 weeks, which is like a normal planning application, but the issue with this is if they do not deal with the application within 56 days, on the 57th day, the applicant gets consent by default.
Wow.
So you get deemed, it's called deemed consent.
Yeah.
So the councils seriously have to shake a tail feather to get these things done. And otherwise, it all the benefit is in the favour of the developer or the owner or the investor. So that's why people, the next reason, and I'm sorry, I'm rattling on.
No, it's good.
The next reason why people are excited by this is the council, the application fee to submit the application to the council is £80.
Okay.
Now, I did one recently that was for 68 flats.
Yeah.
The council application fee was £80. If that had been a full planning application, it would have been over £25,000.
Wow.
Just the council application fee. Now, that comes off your bottom line.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about your own financial position.
Yeah.
That comes off your profit margin. So you can see why these things are appealing to people. The next thing, there's lots of reasons. You can see there's lots of benefits. And this is why lots of people have got excited about this. The next issue is there are no Section 106 contributions.
Yep.
Now, Section 106 agreements are, they're a mechanism. They're a vehicle, a legal agreement by which it allows councils to approve applications that wouldn't necessarily be approvable if they didn't. It's about provision of affordable housing or leisure or community facilities, those kinds of things. But with prior approval, with the office to residential conversions, there is no Section 106 contribution required. They cannot get you for that. Now, that in and of itself can mean either thousands of pounds, hundreds of thousands of pounds in some cases, or it can mean that you have to provide affordable housing within your proposal. Now, you can imagine if you're trying to sell either off plan or you're trying to sell to investors, investors are not going to be terribly impressed or terribly incentivized to buy if you have affordable housing on there and you're going to be having council housing benefit tenants
yep.
moving in to this, you know, glitzy market development.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, that's a massive, massive gain, massive benefit. But you need to remember that all prior approval applications can be chargeable for the community infrastructure levy. So SIL may be is chargeable. That's a fixed tariff. It cannot be negotiated. And each council's fixed tariff will be different.
And approximately, what's the cost? Like, I know they're different, but do they vary wildly, or...?
I can't say. Some of them will be £50 per square metre for community infrastructure levy. There is one section of Wandsworth that is called Nine Elms, which is a thin sliver of land right on the banks of the Thames.
Yep.
So you're getting an idea of, you know, the value of this kind of area of land. It's called Nine Elms. The community infrastructure levy, as far as I understand, don't quote me, but it's a lot, but I think it's £550 per square metre.
Wow.
So you can imagine if you put massive tower blocks along this, you can imagine it's not the footprint, it's every floor, it's every square metre.
Wow.
£550. So you can imagine that the contributions for SIL in that area are going to run into millions.
I've got it. Okay. So because planning for me has always been quite a complicated affair. That's what I think. And
I rely on people like you thinking that it is complicated.
Yeah.
And that's why they come to me and use my services.
And I would always recommend. No, but I think that's good because I would recommend, you know, anyone who's getting involved in property, you need to speak to an expert first. Otherwise, you're doing it without a bloody clue. And why would you do that? Why would you not hedge your bets to being successful rather than just, oh, I tell you what, I'll give it a go and we'll see what happens. Why would you not do that and use a professional person?
There are a lot of people out there who and until they've had something refused.
Yeah.
They don't. It's human nature, isn't it, Dan? You know, I mean, if we think about it,
yeah.
They don't see the value of something until they've been told no.
Yeah.
And then they look at it and they think, oh God, what have I done? And then it's then that they sort of start to come to me. And I've got lots of repeat clients who've had this process, and they now see that the and a lot of clients come to me because they simply do not have the time. Because you have to manage an application. You can't just abandon it and hope that it'll be all right. It's like your baby. It's like leaving a small child in the middle of a shopping mall. You don't do it.
Yeah.
You have to monitor. And lots of people, if they don't understand the process, a lot of people do understand the process, but they just simply haven't got the time.
Yeah.
They leave everything with me and they move on to the next site because, you know, they're busy property developers and investors.
Yeah.
And so they just want me to sort everything out and leave it with me. But a lot of people do get stung the first time. And sometimes they come to me and say, oh, well, I want you to appeal this. And usually I won't. I'm not in the business of making any kind of money for my business doing appeals, because a lot of times people come to me with a proposal either from a local person or an architect or somebody else, some other, or a survey, or somebody who's done this for them and doesn't understand and is not up to date with the planning process.
Yeah.
And if you get one slight thing wrong, it can mean that you get a refusal. So you've then gone through 8 to 10, 12 weeks with nothing to show at the end of it. Now, sometimes people will come to me and say, appeal this, and I usually look at it and say, sometimes I say yes, and I have done and then gone on to be successful and get planning permission. Mm. But a lot of the time, I just can't. And a lot of the time, what has happened is you have jeopardized your position.
Yeah.
Because what you will have done is you've shown your hand to the council.
Yep.
So they know now exactly what your end game is.
Yep.
And with a lot of clients, I have a strategy and say, right, it may be long and drawn out, but ultimately it gets you what you want in the end.
Yep.
So we have a strategy of you submit this application first, and then another application for this, and then a third application, and then by the time you've got that, you've got everything in place. Now, again, property investors out there, they don't want to spend the money, or they don't want to drag the process out, even though at the end of it they'll have success.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of property investors are looking at their bottom line all the time, and if they think they're going to have to pay 5, 10, 15 grand, whatever it is, depending on the size of the project, if they think they're going to have to pay planning consultant for that on top of everything else they've got to do, then a lot of people will try and cut corners.
Yep. I've got it. And then it gets rejected, not all the time, but it does get rejected. And then, as you say, we've shown the hand.
Yeah. The problem is a lot of people get away with it. They'll get away with it for maybe two or three applications.
Yeah.
And then they'll build up and they'll be getting bigger and their business will be growing and they'll be getting bigger projects. And they've got away with small projects and they've dealt with them and they've been approved. But possibly, maybe only by the skin of their teeth. And then they get to the big project and they think, oh, it's all right, we'll do it exactly as we've done it before. And the bigger project, and it doesn't work for larger projects.
Yeah.
So, you know, people get a bit sort of blasé about it and say, oh, yeah, I don't need a planning consultant, I'll just do it myself. And then they get to the bigger project and it doesn't work because it needs a lot more information, a lot more input.
So for people who are just starting out, can you give me some examples of people that have done some commercial or offices to residential, but like some starter type stuff?
Right. Well, I don't know whether they're starter type stuff, but the smaller elements. I mean, I had one recently that was a large three-storey semi-detached, almost like Victorian villa type thing.
Yeah.
Three stories. It had been converted a few years ago to offices, and it was used for general offices. It wasn't used for accountants or other professional stuff or financial stuff.
Yeah.
And so it was used for general offices. We submitted a planning application to convert it to flats. Now, it helped that the property next door was still in residential use.
Yeah.
So it was a large property. So we split. I got one of my use architectural technologists. They do my drawings for me, and I do a one-stop shop package with staged payments and all of this. So I instructed these guys. They went down and had a look at it, and they drew up. They did the survey, they drew up the existing, how the offices were laid out, and there were a lot of stud partitions and things that just needed ripping out.
Yep.
But they also deal with the layout of the proposed flats. And so they did all of that, put all of the bathrooms in, the shower rooms, made sure all of the staircases would comply with building regs, because we also offer a service of submitting the building regs approval as well.
Yep.
So we did all of that. I then oversee everything to make sure that we're satisfied that it will comply with all of the four criteria that I've said earlier, the transport and highways, contamination, flood risk, and the noise. It wasn't at that time because the noise assessment had just come in.
Yeah.
I've not done one in the last two or three weeks. So we then submit the application. The planning department did ask for some additional information. But they were asking for additional information that they really ought not to have been asking for.
Okay.
And I did say to the planner, well, you know, you do, and a lot of, you've got to be careful with this, a lot of councils don't understand the prior approval process.
Yeah.
They simply don't. A lot of councils do, and they're absolutely brilliant, and they're bang on it, and they know what they're doing, but there are some few councils out there that just don't understand it. They asked for some additional information. Now, I could have just said to them, no, you don't need that information. I'm not giving it to you.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a big deal for me to sort the information out. Sent it to them and said, you don't really need this, but as a goodwill gesture, I'm giving you the information that you're requesting. And I knew that it would only support our case.
Yeah.
So ultimately, we then get planning permission for this large property, five flats, two beds, and the rest were one beds, and that helped because we had a mix of types. We had two beds because councils are looking for a mix. They don't just want one bed apartments all over the place.
Yeah.
Although they can't prevent you if it's a prior approval, but it did help that we had two larger two beds, so you could have a family with maybe one or two children in there. And then smaller one-bed apartments. And that got approved. There was a bit of car parking on the front, and there was there was quite a bit of garden at the back that was split into amenity space for the flats. So that worked. That was a smaller one, five flats, as I said. Most of the other ones that I've done are the larger buildings to 50 or 60 flats.
Okay.
But that's a starter one if you find a small office somewhere.
Yeah.
In a residential area, or possibly an existing dwelling that's been converted to offices, been used for 3 or 4 years for offices. It's the general office, and it can be submitted for a change of use to residential.
Perfect. One of my experiences was when we were converting, it was just a three-bed semi on two floors, and we were just converting it into a flat above and a flat below. And the whole street was in uproar because we're converting it, and they tried to oppose the planning application.
Oh, yeah.
They got
a
petition together. They wrote to the local MP, who were quite well known in Leeds because my dad's a wedding photographer, who's very, very well known. And, you know, I literally went to three job interviews in one day, and each interviewer, my dad had done their wedding sort of thing. So it was really, you know, it's quite well known. So the MP didn't like my dad for whatever reason, and he got involved and tried to reject it as well. But one of the arguments was they said that this is a very family orientated area. Well, that went straight against them because obviously the council doesn't want just families. It wants, like you say, a mix of residential types. And so anyway, we got it approved and the highways agency got involved, but there's loads of car parking on it and so on. But I just thought it was really funny that everyone's saying, oh, no, it's only families in this area. And it's like, oh, that's rather prejudiced of you. Are single people not allowed to live here as well? So anyway, we got it through. But
the thing is, though, there are some councils, and I think Oxford is one.
Yeah.
In fact, I know Oxford is one, where they do have a specific planning policy that says in certain areas the single family dwelling house will be protected, and it will be protected from conversion. Now, other councils in the London boroughs, for example, have areas, and they call them different, they've all got different names. And there's one particular council that has a policy about conversion stress.
Yeah.
And they don't want the properties, the single family dwelling houses, to be separated.
I agree.
Into flats or into HMOs. But if they've got those policies in place, and those policies are robust, then the council will refuse the application. And it's very difficult then to go to appeal and to fight against that policy, because if the council can prove that they've got that policy in there for a very good reason, and that they are protecting family areas, and they're not just trying to do it as a blanket, in Oxford's example, they have a small they have small areas where they're trying to protect family dwellings. Because what happens is you split everything into flats, then you have double the number of cars, and you have tend to have double the number of people. Not always, of course, but you get single people in there.
Yeah.
But arguably, you then get double the requirement for amenity space, double the requirement for community and leisure facilities, and it has a knock-on effect. So arguably, it's an intensification in the use of the area.
Yeah. I've got it. And I think in certain parts of Oxford, obviously, there's the university there. So what would happen if you converted everything and made it smaller? You're just going to ram it with full of students. Now, I've got a house in Hyde Park in Leeds, and it's just like that. And it's really brought the area down because it's just full of student houses, you know, big HMOs.
Obviously, and we must talk about this, obviously, with HMOs and any kind of conversions to smaller units, even though HMOs are just meant to be a single dwelling house that has shared facilities by up to six people.
Yeah.
If it goes over that, then it becomes a class C4, a sui generis use, and you need planning permission.
Yeah.
But obviously, a lot of the councils have seen these, especially Manchester is the big one, and Southampton and Oxford are the same. Manchester is simply, to my knowledge, not approving any HMOs. They have a blanket Article 4 direction across the entire council area, and an Article 4 direction is a mechanism that withdraws the permitted development, because you can convert a single dwelling house to a six-person HMO.
Yep.
It's not about bedrooms, it's about people.
Yep.
And I've had this discussion about 10 times on Facebook where people are saying, oh, well, I've got, you know, I've got two people in each bedroom. I don't need planning permission. Oh, yes, you do. Because if you go over six people, you need planning permission. Yep. But the Article 4 direction is a council's way of removing permitted development rights. So you have to, it doesn't mean you can't do it. It just means that you have to submit a planning application.
Yeah.
For the HML. Then if you submit planning application, actually, you can submit it for free. The council can't charge you a fee because they have removed the permitted development rights. So you're having to submit the application. Now, a lot of people are successful in submitting applications for HMLs in Article 4 direction areas, and they still get approved. That is if there is not a huge problem and the council are not trying to crack down on all HMOs in the area. Now Manchester aren't. Manchester had a huge student accommodation problem in certain hotspots in the city and on the in the suburbs, in the outlying areas. So that's what they did. They put a blanket Article 4 direction. It removed all the permitted development rights so that every change has to be submitted as an application. And the council are simply not approving them because they've got they're saying they've got too many in certain areas.
I've got it. And before we came on, we were just talking about HMOs, because HMOs have been massive for the last, I'd say, 3 to 5 years, really.
Yeah, they have.
And everyone's advertising them as the way out, but they take a lot more effort to fill, a lot more wear and tear. But also, I think, I mean, we're lucky in some extent with HMOs that we've got this net migration, lots of people leaving home earlier as well. And so those people will be moving into HMOs because we don't want to stay at mum and dad's and so on. But I think at some point, we talked about this briefly, we're going to run into some sort of bubble with HMOs because there's far too many being converted into HMOs. And right now, I think there's enough tenants, but it depends where you are. Jim Halliburton, who I'm sure you know, was one of our podcast guests, and he's got like, well, I'd have to think how many tenants Jim's got these days in Milton Keynes, is it? I think he is. And it's huge. You know, he must at some point reach a point where he's struggling to rent rooms out because it's flooded with HMO rooms. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm a bit concerned that the HMO bubble at some point, and you know, I mean that's very vague, but I am a bit concerned that at some point the HMO bubble is going to burst. Mm. And there are varying levels. I mean, I know there's lots of people on Facebook, and I'll give Julian Maurice a plug.
Yeah.
He's doing boutique HMOs. You probably know Julian, and lots of people listening will know Julian. And he's doing boutique HMOs, and lots of people are putting pictures on Facebook and on the social media that show absolutely beautiful rooms. They're dressed, they're neat, they're tidy, they're clean, there's no sort of wallpaper hanging off the ceiling, there's no mould. They're carpeted and they're beautiful.
Yeah.
And so from that point of view, I think the HMO process and the people who do HMOs has shifted.
Mm.
And to be honest, because you've probably got a lot more canny tenants, where the problems seem to occur are when you're putting tenants in there who have very little choice.
Yeah.
And they're living in exceptionally poor conditions.
Yeah.
And you get HMOs that have had the central heating ripped out.
Mm.
You get HMOs that you can only have meters for your electricity and gas. And you also get some of these HMOs that have been, they have a bathroom and a kitchenette within the same room.
Yeah.
That is no longer an HMO. Mm. If you are creating self-contained units, you need planning permission.
Yeah.
And again, there was someone in a discussion on Facebook the other day. It needs planning permission. A self-contained unit, doesn't matter within its, if it's within the building, doesn't matter if it's not got its own entrance, it does not matter. If it's self-contained, and I know there are lots of other people who use this as a model for their HMOs,
yep.
And I just see that from a planning point of view, that is storing up trouble. And the reason that I say that, I think the boutique HMOs are fabulous, and I think they will go a long way because people are creating. I was listening to Ash DuPerry the other night. He was at Manchester Property Networking Club, and Ash creates houses where people, the tenants all get on. You know, they'll go and pick up people's shopping. And,
yes.
You know, they're texting each other and they're creating groups on Facebook.
Yeah.
That's absolutely superb. And when you have a true HMO like that, where you have people with their separate rooms, but they come together in, say, a kitchen or a dining room, or they come together, and there's a laundry facility, or they come together to watch TV.
Yep.
Now that works really well, but when you end up with all of the communal areas ripped out and turned into bedrooms as well, then there's nowhere for people to live.
Yeah.
And so they're like teenagers.
It's a bedsit, in other words, yeah.
Well, yeah, and the problem is the planning legislation hasn't kept up with this. There's a lot of people who are wanting to do these. Oh, God, they used to do them in the 80s. Barrett did something called duplexes, and they were literally, you pulled the bed out of the wall. They were brand new blocks, and you had a kitchen, a bathroom, and one room, and you pulled the bed out of the wall. And they were called duplexes, and we would call them bed sits now, but they were entirely self-contained. So that's there are two, as far as I'm concerned, there are two very different worlds from an HMO point of view. And I've seen some lovely HMOs, and that I know that there are some not so lovely HMOs out there. So that's that. But I have to say, if you are looking to invest or develop and convert places in Wales, the Welsh Assembly government there is no longer permitted development rights to convert a single dwelling house to a six-person HMO in Wales. So that, if Wales have done that, the issue is how long might it be before the England legislation is the same?
Yep.
There is a possibility. Now, whether the government would have guts to do this at this point in time, because obviously HMOs are creating places for people to live, but there may come a time where the Welsh model is followed and everything, a single dwelling house to an HMO, everything has to have planning permission. There are no permitted development rights, and that may be the way that this goes. Now, if that is the way that it goes, then obviously people who are looking to develop and you know, change terraced houses to six-person HMOs and sort of cram people in tiny little rooms, then that is going to disappear. Is it going to come? I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball.
Yeah.
If it's happened in Wales, then, you know, it may be a possibility.
One question I've got for you, and I think I know the answer, and I think the answer is the kitchen, but I'll ask you, what makes a self-contained room self-contained, like from the HMO point of view?
If you don't need to step outside that room to provide all of the functions that you need to live.
So what if you put, let's say, a microwave and a kettle in there?
Well, if you get, again, it depends on degree. And there are some councils that will ask you to put sinks and hand basins and all of that kind of stuff into the room. So it depends on degree. But if you have created a kitchenette where someone can make brew and do a chicken ping and ding in the microwave, then you've created an entirely self-contained unit.
Got it.
Now, I know there are people out there who this is the model that they work to, and they have this argument about building regulations. But I have to say that if you are challenged, or you know, if you're going to raise finance on this building, then your lenders are certainly, in my opinion, going to ask for your planning permission.
Yeah.
And if they don't, then there's an issue that if you do decide to sell it because you want to raise some money to put it somewhere else and develop elsewhere, there is a likelihood that the conveyancing solicitors for any prospective purchaser, if they know what they're doing, are going to ask for the planning permission.
Yeah.
If you haven't got that and you're either in a position of needing to raise finance or you're in a position of needing to sell, then the last thing you want to be doing then is to be going round and trying to get retrospective planning permission.
So I think the advice here is do it right. I mean, why would you not do it right anyway?
Yeah, I know. I'm a bit anal about planning, but you know, the rules are there. I mean, I will bend the rules and use the rules sort of against itself almost. And I will bend the rules to snapping point.
Yeah.
But you know, breaking the rules, it just stores a whole lot of trouble and just makes life a lot more difficult.
So, Linda, talk to me about... there's two other things I want to talk to you about then. The first one's land development, and then the second one's flipping.
Yes.
Just talk to me about land development first, if you would.
Right. Well, if I can just talk about flipping first.
Yeah.
I'm sure everybody, potentially, who will be listening to this podcast, who is a developer or an investor, or just has a small portfolio of properties, will know what flipping means. It means that you... buy a property or a piece of land, you get planning permission to increase the value of that land, and you flip it on.
Yeah.
You put it back in an auction, you sell it, you put a board up, you use estate agent, whatever you want to do. But you sell it on with the benefit of that uplift in the value of the land that planning permission gives it.
Yeah.
So that's flipping. Now, I have a little sort of bête noir. I have a real bugbear. People are going around, I started shouting at people. People are going around talking about planning gains. And there was, you know, there was something in one of the magazines, and somebody was talking about it on a property networking meeting the other day. And I thought, oh, for God's sake. planning gains. Do not use the term planning gains. It is being bandied about all over the place in the property networking circles. Planning gain, if you go into a planning department and start talking about planning gain in planning legislation terms is a very specific phrase. If you go into the planning department and start talking about planning gain, they think you're going to sign a Section 106 agreement.
Okay.
They think you want to give them affordable housing.
Yeah.
They think you want to give them cash or contributions. Because planning gain means planning gain for the benefit of the community.
Yep.
It does not mean planning gain to be trousered by a property developer.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk about the profit that you're going to make, and we all agree that profit is not a four-letter word, please talk about planning uplift.
Yeah.
It's uplift in the value of the land. Don't talk about planning gain. It's a very specific planning phrase, and it means you are giving, in developing land or a property, you will be giving something to the community as a quid pro quo for developing this land.
Got it.
So stop with the planning game. So that's flipping. Flipping is you get the value of the uplift in the value of the land that planning permission gives. So then you flip it on, you sell it, and you'll have to have paid out some money. And there's a risk involved in that. But that's what you're doing with flipping.
No. Quick question, just on the flipping, because I know some people in the past, and I don't know what the rules are, because I think they've changed, and then I think they changed back, but you can clarify. So you buy a house with some land at the side. What's the availability of getting planning permission on that land these days to build another domicile?
I can't answer that question. It will very much depend on the size of the land. It will very much depend on the orientation of the house. It will very much depend on the council.
Yeah.
Every single council will view these things differently. I had a guy who said he got planning permission for one of these things on the side of a house, and that somebody else had built the same thing on the other side of this access of this road. Now, having looked at it, it didn't look to me like a house would fit.
Yeah.
But it had approval, and he wanted to do some other things to it as well.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, you've got to be very careful, because there are very specific privacy distances, and each council will have a different requirement for a garden, an outside garden area, amenity space. You'll have to keep the amenity space for the parent, the existing dwelling. You'll have to provide car parking for each dwelling. So it's difficult to specifically assess, because every site there'll be, you know, areas with large sites, and then if you've got dirty great big tree in the middle of it,
yep,
that may be protected and you can't remove it, so that stops your development. There are all sorts of things. I can't say yes, you'll get planning permission for that.
If you've got a tree in the middle, you just build around it. Keep the tree, just build around it.
I'm sure I think there's lots of properties where they've actually built and the tree goes up through the house.
Yeah.
You know, and there was one in Spain on the TV where they've got a big rock in the middle of the house and they've built around that. And
amazing.
Fabulous. Imaginative stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So, okay, talk to me about land development.
Right, so land development. It's a lot of people come to me with sites at the back, big, long gardens and houses.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, we're going to develop this and we're going to put something on the back of here. And you think, well, no, you're not really, because if you have to access through houses, then you're causing disturbance. That yeah. can be a problem. You have to provide privacy distances of something like between 20 to 22 metres between habitable room to habitable room.
Yeah.
So if you've got two, you know, living room or bedroom windows facing each other, you need a distance between the two of around about 20 to 22 metres. That takes up a lot of space. That eats up a lot of space.
Yeah.
If you've got habitable rooms facing a side elevation, then in England, you have to keep around about 12 metres.
Okay.
Now, some of these distances can be tweaked a bit. And then people tend to look at a site and think, oh, I can build right up to the boundaries and all of this kind. Well, you can't do that either, because if there's any kind of dominant impact,
yep,
or you're going to be overshadowing somebody else's rear garden, then again, that will not be acceptable in planning terms.
Yep.
Every single that, you know, if you do want to do this, and if you've got the time as developers or investors, have a look at the council's policies. Now, sometimes they hide them, but usually there will be a development section somewhere that tells you all about the distances and gives you ideas of how ideally development should be laid out or set out. Now, if what you're thinking of doing is just putting one additional house on land, that tends to be slightly easier, because you can look at, or you have to look at everything that's around it. The trick with planning is you can't just look at these things in isolation.
Yeah.
Planning is there to protect everybody else's amenity and to protect, it's about what it looks like and whether people's privacy and amenity are going to be protected. So every single, I say this all the time, it's like a bit of a mantra now, every single council will be different, every single site will be different, and every single proposal will be different.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to carbon copy and yep. say, oh, I did this on that site down the road, I'm going to do the same up the road. It doesn't work like that, because there will be one area that is slightly different, and that means that it won't be acceptable in planning terms.
I've got it.
So it's very difficult to give a one-stop shop answer for land development. It just has to be looked at. But I do that with my architectural technologists, and they do draft drawings, and then we look at whether something is feasible or not.
Brilliant. Well, I think what we've done in this 45 minutes is we've given people an idea as to what the potential upside is through planning. And also, really, that the first port of call is just to pick up the phone and give you a call. If people do want to contact you, what's the best way, either website or phone or...
Right. Yes, thanks, Dan. I'm doing a course. If anybody's interested, and I know it's probably going to be a bit late, but I'm doing a course in Manchester. I did one in London about a month ago.
Okay.
On the permitted developments and office to residential specifically because of the new legislation that's come in. I'm doing this in Manchester on Saturday, this Saturday the 4th of June, and it's just an afternoon, so it's not going to fry your brains or anything, but it's fairly intensive. It gives you, if you're interested in this area of development, it gives you everything that you need to know and what you should be looking at if you're going to the auctions. Because there's not just office to residential, there's agricultural buildings, there's industrial buildings,
yeah.
There's all sorts of different casinos, different buildings that you could now potentially change under this same process. So that's that. If you want to contact me, just send an email, have a look at my website, www.planitright, that's planitright.co.uk. Send an email to admin@planitright.co.uk.
Perfect.
Telephone numbers are on the website. And yeah, please contact me. I do a telephone consultation, which is £97 for half an hour. It's a no-brainer, really.
Yeah, I agree.
And you can do that by emailing the admin or going on online.
And for those people who are listening to this podcast after the 4th of June, if you just jump onto Planit Right, you'll be able to get Linda's contact details, find you on Facebook anyway, and then I'm pretty sure you're running these events at least a couple of times a year.
Another one in Wembley. And please, if anybody is interested in this, I'm speaking at a landlord, a council and landlord property forum with Brent Council on the 28th of June.
Okay.
I'm toying with the idea because I'm down there. I'm thinking, I wonder if people would be interested in coming to a midweek thing in Wembley. It's easy to get to. It's Wembley Park on the tube. So if anybody's interested in that, I will post it up on Facebook and see if we get any interest. If we get any interest, then I will do it.
That's perfect. Linda, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day today. I really, really appreciate it. And loads of really useful content in there. And a big thank you from me. Big thank you for everyone who's listening. And we'll speak to you soon.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Take care.
The Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.